From KUOW Seattle, this is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I remember I was around 10 years old when I first heard about the unified theory. Our family believed in science, but I had friends who believed in God who said science doesn't explain everything, and that really bothered me. And one day, my parents' Time magazine arrived, and the cover story was about how scientists were working on a unified theory that would explain everything, and maybe we'll call that scientific explanation God. And I sat on the toilet in my parents' bathroom reading their Time magazine and feeling so happy because finally everything would make sense to everyone and we would stop arguing and stop fighting wars. What I didn't know was on that same day that I was sitting on my parents' toilet at age 10, my next guest was age 12, and one day, he might not explain the entire universe, but Brian, you must know as much as anyone can know about cosmic matter and meaning.
Well, we do work on these unified theories. The kind of idea that fired you up as a 10-year-old has fired me up for the past 30 years, trying to find the mathematical equation that might put all the forces of nature, all matter, into one mathematical tapestry. It's a beautiful goal. We are still working hard to get there.
Brian Greene is a theoretical physicist, a string theorist, a mathematician, and your new book is Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. So you've written books, very popular books about science, quantum theory, and superstring theory, but this new book is about the human condition in the midst of all that science. What does a scientist know about, what do you know about my search for meaning?
Well, everyone has their own search for meaning, and the book basically tries to put that highly personal search within the universal context of the cosmology that takes us from the Big Bang to the emergence of life, the emergence of consciousness, and ultimately asks the question, what do self-reflective conscious beings do when they rise up, look around, wonder where they came from, what they should do, and where we're going? And at least science can give us the backdrop within which that search takes place, and it can also illuminate what it means to be alive and what it means to have consciousness in a way that, for some people, is pretty unfamiliar.
So you just framed it as a story, starting with the Big Bang, and you write in your first chapter, you say, our species makes meaning through stories. The problem is, Brian, when you tell the story of the universe, you don't get 1 second into it before I'm confused.
Yeah.
Will you explain to me how the universe can not start yet and then start?
Yeah, well, why is there something rather than nothing is a question that philosophers have asked for a very long time. And we have some proposals that seek to give an answer to that question, but none of them have reached consensus. What we can do with our theoretical understanding is explain how the universe evolved from a split second after it came into existence. And we can do that with fantastic precision. But we have not really been able to address the question of how it came to be at all.
And how could there even be a beginning of a universe? Because something must have come before. You made a beautiful analogy, though, about time. Yes,
yeah.
You tell us how I could understand how time could work.
Yeah. So we're used to things in the everyday world having a period before they existed, right? Before we existed, even before the Earth existed or the Sun existed. That notion of going further back in time makes sense. But when it comes to the Big Bang, that may be the place where time originates. So the analogy that I like to use is if you're on planet Earth and you're walking north and you pass by someone and say, what direction do I go to go further north? And they point in the northward direction, pass somebody else and say, please tell me which way is north, and they point. When you get to the North Pole and you ask the person there, how do I go further north, they'll look at you quizzically and say, you can't go further north than the North Pole. This is where north begins. That analogy may apply to time. Go back a billion years, 5 billion, 10 billion, but when you get to the Big Bang, the notion of going further back in time may make no sense at all.
And if that idea that north makes no sense because you're a certain point on this ball, if that doesn't work for you, I like your idea that that the idea of temperature doesn't necessarily really mean anything except in a context.
Absolutely. We all know what it means to be hot and cold, but science has gone further and noted that things are hot when their constituents, their particles, are moving quickly. Things are cold when their particles are moving slowly. So temperature is this average, emergent quality of the world. It's not fundamental. Time might be like that, too. There may be atoms and molecules that make up time itself. We are struggling to figure out their identity, if that idea is correct. But that notion of time emerging only when the particles are in a certain configuration is one that would give a very different perspective on what time is.
That's cool. This is theoretical physicist Brian Greene. The book is Until the End of Time. By the way, you're speaking tonight at 7 o'clock. You get to go to a church in Seattle and hear a theoretical physicist tell you that we're just made up of particles. This is the University Temple United Methodist Church tonight at 7 o'clock with my colleague Ross Reynolds and you talking. So go to that. So we just discussed the beginning of the story, pre-Big Bang. The ending doesn't get much better. Like, this is the worst story ever told, Brian. The beginning is confusing and the ending is hopeless. All life and thought will disappear.
Yeah, well, I don't consider it hopeless.
Okay.
I understand where you're coming from, because when you recognize that science tells us that in the far future, all structure from planets to stars to galaxies to people will disintegrate. The particles will all fall apart and waft through an ever larger and colder universe. It can feel as though it is bleak.
Some of your students cry at the prospect.
They have. But ultimately, when you change your perspective and realize that what this is telling us is there is no ultimate answer floating out there in the void waiting for us to discover it. Which means that we need to look at how we came to be and recognize the wonder that we are here at all. You and I emerge from a sequence of quantum processes that could have turned out differently every step of the way, yielding a universe in which we would not be here. And yet against those astounding odds, we are here. And not only are we here, we can do things. We can experience beauty. We can illuminate mystery. We can gain an insight into the nature of reality. That's where the meaning and purpose comes from. That's where the antidote to bleakness resides.
But you know so much stuff that makes no, I can't grasp about alternate dimensions and multiverses. So how do you know that there couldn't be an ultimate answer?
There could be. So the best we can do is look out at the world, understand it with the greatest precision we can with our mathematical equations that build our physical theories, make predictions, see how they agree with observations, and gain confidence that we are heading toward truth. But you're right, we don't know everything by any means, and it could be that one day we walk outside, the clouds part, and the grand deity from above says, here is the real answer, you've guys been confused all these decades and centuries. Could that happen? Yes, it's possible. Do I think it's going to happen? I don't.
I think a lot of people, maybe most people, believe that our life on Earth is proof that the universe is not all about decay. Earth went from a rock with chemicals on it to a less decayed, more ordered civilization.
Yes, it did. And that's fully in keeping with our understanding of the so-called second law of thermodynamics, which is the law of decay, that the universe goes from order to disorder.
Is this entropy?
This is entropy. Entropy tends to go up, overwhelmingly likely to go up. But the beautiful thing, which I explain in some detail in the book, is that entropy can go down in a local region of space so long as in the process of that happening, a greater amount of entropy is released to the surrounding environment. So the net goes up, even though you can get pockets of order. The sun is a pocket of order. The earth is a pocket of order. You and I are pockets of order. And look, we eat, we breathe, and we give off heat, and we give off waste. That is the entropic contribution that life makes to the environment, which allows us to keep our entropy low. And that's how we can maintain our order throughout our lives.
You call it the entropic two-step.
Yeah, I see it as a dance, the entropic two-step. Exactly. Entropy goes down here so long as it goes up over there, so that on balance, it goes overall in the upward direction.
What about consciousness, though? Again, that doesn't seem like decay. Consciousness feels like a sustaining cosmic force. Where does it come from?
I don't know where it comes from, but my best guess, and not everybody agrees with this, is that consciousness is nothing but a highly organized set of particles that exist, in our case, in a gloppy gray structure inside of this cave, this bone cave on top of our shoulders. And when the particles have appropriate organization, the movement of those particles yields the inner sensation of reflection, of thought, of emotion. It all emerges from the laws of physics acting on the particles when the particles are appropriately arranged.
And how do you live believing that?
Because it allows
me. I don't mean how do you not I mean, yeah. How do you stay alive? I mean, how do you behave believing what you do?
Yeah, no, I totally get what you're saying. And my view is that this makes consciousness and life even more impressive and spectacular, because think about it. You and I are made of the very same particles that make up this coffee cup or that microphone that you're talking into, governed by the very same laws of physics. And yet, if the particles are appropriately arranged, look at what they can do. They can think, they can feel, they can love, they can hate, they can strive, they can achieve. And you don't need anything else but the particles and laws. No life force, no ultra particle conscious field that somehow we're tapping into. It's just particles and laws. And that to me is where the wonder comes from.
Yeah, but it's only wondrous because we don't understand it yet. I mean, I'm sure an eclipse is, I'm pretty sure it's way less wondrous to us now than it was 10,000 years ago. An echo is way less wondrous. So really, is it about how wonderful things are, or just that we don't understand it, but we're on our way to making everything less amazing?
So I completely disagree with what you just said, because the wonder that I'm describing isn't a wonder that's rooted in ignorance. It's not rooted in lack of understanding. It's rooted in the deep understanding that we have gleaned from science over the last 100 years. We can describe the motion of these particles and the properties of these particles with astounding precision. We can take an electron and we can do a calculation on a piece of paper that predicts its magnetic properties that agree with observations to 10 decimal places after the decimal point. This is not ignorance. This is deep understanding. And the wonder comes from recognizing that simple principles articulated in simple mathematical equations, acting out on a collection of particles, can create incredibly complex structures like you and me and everybody else that can do things that you would never have anticipated just looking at the math and looking at the particles and looking at the equations. It's that kind of wonder, not ignorance, deep understanding.
Brian Greene is the author of Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. And again, he's on stage tonight at University Temple, United Methodist Church, at 7 o'clock. So we talked about consciousness a little bit, and it's just comes from our meat in our bone cave. Could we imbue anything with consciousness? Like if consciousness just comes from particles, then could any particle become conscious?
The right
collection. That coffee cup you mentioned.
If the particles are arranged appropriately, so I don't think a coffee cup would, but it's absolutely conceivable that the work toward artificial intelligence may ultimately yield machines that can think and feel and reflect. Now, it would be very hard to prove that. I mean, how do you ever prove what's happening inside? How do you ever get access to the subjective experience of a complex structure? The truth of the matter is, I don't know that you are conscious, and you don't know that I am. I'm assuming you are, because you're acting in a manner that seems compatible with what I think should be taking place if you are conscious.
That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said.
And so if we have a computer that behaves in the same way, or a digital gadget of some sort that behaves in the same way, we probably will ascribe it a conscious, subjective self-awareness.
That doesn't seem to bug you.
Doesn't at all. I think it is recognition of the fact that consciousness is not as mysterious and as special as we might think because we haven't fully articulated its origin.
That's what I'm saying about consciousness getting less special the more we understand them.
Well, less special in the sense that there's a deep continuity between stars and planets and inanimate matter and ourselves. Mm. But I find that to be deeply impressive,
yeah,
that we're connected to it all in a very deep manner. It doesn't diminish consciousness for me. It actually aggrandizes it, because we have this quality and yet we don't need any special ingredient. We don't need any special law. It's all the same stuff. It just is organized in a manner that yields unexpected and quite spectacular behaviors.
You have said, again, you're a theoretical physicist, you have said that there's no universal morality.
Yeah.
Am I quoting you? Is that a scientific claim?
In a sense, it is.
How could it be a scientific claim?
Well, the claim is this. At the fundamental level of reality, it is the ingredients that make up the world, and it's the laws that govern them. And within those laws, there is no such notion of good or bad, of evil or right. That kind of a notion only emerges when we, using our conscious experience, impose those concepts on the external world. So all I'm saying is these ideas emerge from us, from our experience, from the utility of labeling certain kinds of behaviors as good and others as bad, because some behaviors are good for the group and this social exchange that allows us to prevail, and some behaviors are not good for that kind of social interaction. And from that perspective, the fundamental laws and the fundamental ingredients have no notion of morality. It's something that we impose on the external world because it's a useful idea and it's useful to do so.
Yeah, most of us take that idea that morality is useful for the social group, and that's good enough for us.
Yeah.
But from your perspective, how can you take the idea of good or bad seriously? I mean, on some level, are you less moral because of your understanding?
I hope not.
But separate from knowing that morality is good for the group, and I want to have a reputation and friends and all that, but that's different than fundamentally thinking something is right or wrong.
I don't think so. So the word level was part of how you articulated your question, and I think that's the vital word to focus upon, because you need various levels of understanding to have a complete articulation of what the world is. You have the physicist reductionist account that we've been talking about, particles and laws. You got the chemist account, which puts those together into molecules and atoms. The biologist puts it together in cells and life. And as you go up the chain, you come to the philosopher and the psychologist and the neuroscience. And that's where the ideas of consciousness and the ideas of morality come into the story. So when I say they're not fundamental, I mean they don't exist down at the reductionist level. But they are just as important because all of these levels matter to a complete understanding of the world.
I want to ask you about things like multiverses, there are alternate universes that coexist with ours on parallel dimensional planes.
Yeah.
Why does it help us to know that kind of stuff?
Well, there are some...
How do I even evaluate that that's true or not true, and why does it matter?
Good. So first thing, note that these ideas don't come out of the wild-eyed imagination of a scientist who hasn't had enough sleep.
Oh.
It comes out of the mathematics that we have shown to be relevant to the world by virtue of observation and experiment. We push the math to its limit, and it suggests to us that there might be these other universes. That's not proof, but it's the reason why we're motivated to take this idea seriously. Moreover, if you allow for the possibility that there are other universes, there are a handful of problems that we have not been able to make any progress on, which all of a sudden become pretty simple to solve.
What's an example?
Well, for instance, there is something called dark energy right now, which is causing the expansion of space to speed up. And when you measure the amount of dark energy based on the speed up of the galaxies, you get a ridiculously crazy sounding number. It's a decimal point followed by 120 zeros and then a 138. And we look at a number like that and we say, how are we ever going to explain that crazy number? Like, our equations have ones and twos and square roots and pi, nothing like that crazy number. But if there are many, many universes, all of a sudden there's a possible solution, which is this dark energy could have different values across all the different universes, and we just happen to inhabit a universe in which the value takes the value that it currently does. So rather than looking for a first principles mathematical explanation, it now becomes an environmental feature of a landscape that has many universes, each endowed with a different value of the dark energy.
We have a minute and a half left, that's all. So what do you think will be humanity's next big achievement in understanding the universe?
I think it will be deeply understanding the nature of time, like we were discussing before. I think if we could really put our finger on the ingredients, if there are such things, that make up time, the molecules and atoms, if you will, that when they come together, yield time itself, like molecules and atoms can yield tables and chairs, the identification of those fundamental entities will, in my mind, be the next revolution.
In your lifetime?
It's
in whose
possible.
Lifetime? Really?
Yes, that's right. So even right now, there's work in quantum gravity and string theory suggesting that we might understand what the threads stitching the fabric of space actually are made of. And those threads may be made of quantum entanglement. And we've got 16 seconds left, so I can't really explain that in detail. But yes, there is great progress on these deep questions.
Will you come back and tell us about it?
I'd be happy to.
Okay. The book is Until the End of Time, Mind, Matter, and Our Search for Meaning in an Evolving Universe. This is from Columbia University, theoretical physicist Brian Greene, and he is, there'll be much more. University Temple, United Methodist Church tonight at 7 o'clock with KUOW's own Ross Reynolds. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We'll be right back.